You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered.
Listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community and supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon. From the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB, this is Don Guerra.
And this is Todd Wicks, and this is the Daily Local News for Tuesday, April 23rd, 2019.
We're realizing that we're on the tip of an iceberg here, and that our state officials are just completely, they're operating in the dark when it comes to forest management in terms of understanding what the impacts of their logging are on Indiana's native biodiversity.
The Indiana Forest Alliance, along with hundreds of volunteer scientists, are nearing completion of a five-year eco-blitz aimed at documenting Indiana's ecosystems. WFHB correspondent Norm Holey speaks with IFA Director Jeff Stent later in the program in today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, Glenda Murray talks about Maud Showers, one of the most influential women in Monroe County in the early 1800s. That's coming up in this week's edition of the Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana. But first, your daily headlines.
Former Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt has been hired as an energy lobbyist in Indiana. As WFHB's Graham Capito reports, Pruitt is expected to lobby against coal plant closures across the state.
President Trump's first EPA head, Scott Pruitt, resigned in July of 2018 amid reported ethical violations and mismanagement of funds, according to NPR News. Pruitt registered last week as a lobbyist in Indiana. He was hired by Hallador Energy Company. Although it is based in Denver, Colorado, Hallador maintains substantial coal mining interests throughout Indiana. Hallador owns Sunrise Coal, the second largest coal mining company in Indiana. In a press release on Saturday, Hallador said Pruitt was hired to, quote, protect the ratepayers of Indiana from Vectren and NIPSCO rate increases. Vectren and NIPSCO, two Indiana-based utility companies, have petitioned the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission to close down many of their coal-powered energy plants. Hallador says coal plant closures would increase Indiana utility customers' electricity bills. Hallador and former EPA head Scott Pruitt would be lobbying against Vectren and NIPSCO's coal plant closures. The Indiana utility companies have denied closing coal plants would lead to an increase in utility rates for customers, according to Environment and Energy News. While Vectren and NIPSCO say customers will face initial rate increases, they say their plans to cut down on coal power and shift toward renewable energy will save customers money long term. Indiana is one of the top 10 coal producers in the nation, with about 75% of coal mined in Indiana used in state. Indiana is the third highest coal-consuming state, after Texas and Illinois, and it ranks second in coal consumption for electricity production after Texas. Additionally, the state's steel manufacturing and automotive sectors also contribute to coal consumption. Indiana ranks third in the nation when it comes to industrial coal consumption, and 10% of coal mined in the state goes to work in steel mills as industrial coke. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, coal-fired electricity generation is on the decline. In 2017, 70% of the state's megawatt hours were produced via coal. The cheapened production of natural gas via oil shale and fracking has largely contributed to the decreasing use of coal as an energy resource. Renewable energy is also eating away at coal's market share. Over half of the 200 megawatts brought online in 2017 in the state were from renewable energy sources. Wind produced just 5% of the state's power in 2017. For WFHB, I'm Graham Capito.
Sunrise Coal did not return a request for comment for that story.
A new Indiana University study found that a majority of Indiana residents believe in climate change. The study was conducted by the Indiana University Prepared for Environmental Change Grand Challenge Initiative. The study found that approximately 80% of Indiana residents believe climate change is happening, and approximately 75% support addressing the impact of climate change. According to the study, majorities of Indiana residents agree that effects of climate change will negatively impact the state. Such effects include increased flooding, increased drought, unpredictable weather patterns, and intensified allergy seasons. In particular, residents believe that drought and hotter summers will negatively impact Indiana's agricultural sector. The study also found some divides among Indiana residents based on political lines. For example, more Republicans than Democrats surveyed believe that there is scientific uncertainty about climate change. However, a majority of both Republicans and Democrats said that they support Indiana taking measures to prepare for the effects of climate change on communities. Again, that's according to the Indiana University Grand Challenge study.
The town of Ellettsville will open its History Center next month in the historic town hall at 221 North Sales Street. Ellettsville Police Chief Jimmy Durnell announced that the History Center's May 4th open house at last night's Ellettsville Town Council meeting. The renovation from Town Hall to History Center has been more than 3 years in the making. Durnell said many of the items on display came from historian and longtime Ellettsville resident Donald Mattson, who died last year. Judy Holmes, a retired librarian, and her husband Alan, an historian, have been instrumental in collecting and arranging artifacts for the Ellettsville History Center. Holmes said the area residents may research their family's history as well as the town's.
They can look for family members, and then they can visit downstairs and look at all the artifacts, pictures, everything about Ellettsville and beyond, and anything that you'd hope to find about your relative and your friends. And we would really like to invite you to come. It looks fabulous.
Interim town manager Mike Farmer said he thinks the new History Center will be, quote, a gem for the town of Ellettsville. The Ellettsville History Center's open house is scheduled for Saturday, May 4th, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m.
The city of Bloomington has initiated a sidewalk participation program. The initiative is open to single-family homeowners in specific neighborhoods designated as community development block grant areas. Public Works Director Adam Wason discussed the federally funded program with the Board of Public Works last week.
So this is a program where the city will, in partnership with residents in certain geographical areas based on the U.S. government's community development block grant program, will participate in a 50-50 match with residents in those geographic areas to make sidewalk improvements.
Wason said applications and a map of CDBG qualifying areas can be found at the city's website, bloomington.in.gov.
So we're trying to get the information out through our normal media channels, through social media and everything else. Any interested residents can type their address in on the website. There's a nice form, and it'll immediately let residents know if they're in the geographic areas that are eligible. The whole intent here is to, with this first round of the sidewalk participation program coming back up, for many, many years, that we wanted to focus on some of the lower income areas where folks might not have the resources to maintain the sidewalks adjacent to their property. So I guess it's a good opportunity to remind the community that the maintenance and repair of sidewalks is the adjacent property owner's responsibility under city code for many, many decades now.
May 15th is the deadline for applications for the Sidewalk Repair Assistance Program. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Don Guerra.
And I'm Todd Wicks. The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
For 5 years, the Indiana Forest Alliance and volunteer researchers from across the country has been gathering data on species living in Indiana's forests. In today's feature report, WFHB correspondent Norm Holey speaks with the IFA's executive director, Jeff Stant, who says they're having trouble finding experts who know about many of the species they're discovering in Indiana's forests.
We divided life into 12 different categories and put teams out there to inventory, survey the plants and animals and fungi and lichens in all those categories. And we have documented an amazing level of biodiversity in the Yellowwood, Morgan, Monroe backcountry area that we've surveyed. It's about a 900-acre tract of hardwood forest there. 320 acres of it is in the Low Gap Nature Preserve. And we are close, the species count now is close to about 4,000 species. And the large preponderance of those species are insects or other invertebrates, and then followed by vascular plants, and then fungi. And I have to say that we could spend another 10 years at the Yellowwood site before we would have adequately characterized the full breadth of biodiversity that we can see is there. And that's because there are many orders and families and groups of insects and other invertebrates in our hardwood forest that there simply aren't any experts studying that closely in North America. And so we are at a loss to survey, let alone identify, hundreds of species of ants and centipedes and millipedes and other invertebrates that are out in these forests. But we clearly are seeing them when we're out in them, and recognizing that there's this storehouse of biodiversity that has just never been documented in an Indiana hardwood forest. And I think it's important to point out this is the first attempt to document the biodiversity that is this comprehensive. And what we're calling this is a baseline survey, because it's the first attempt that we can find anywhere in the literature to actually go into a tract of state forest or national forest that's beyond the century mark in age and find out what is living there in it that's part of that forest ecosystem. There just isn't any other survey of this magnitude that we can find that's been done anywhere on the state forest or the national forest or in the state parks for that matter. But so this is important. It's important to characterize biodiversity because we think that climate change is causing, to quote some scientists, for example, an apocalypse in decline of insect species, native insect species across the planet. Huge declines in reptiles and amphibians and birds and other taxonomic groups of life, but without any baseline data for the largest taxonomic groups like the invertebrates, the insects, and the other arthropods. We don't have a beginning point to measure from to gauge that decline. And so when you hear scientists talking about this huge apocalypse, this huge die-off of species, it appears that we're seeing this, but we don't have a good baseline to measure it from. And the EcoBlitz is an attempt to do that with the forest, the hardwood forest in Indiana, and indeed in the eastern United States. And that's why it's important, because we have a hard time gauging the impact of climate change on biodiversity without it. So at the Yellowwood site, we've documented there are 4,000 different species, but I should point out that's not counting major groups of insects and invertebrates that we can't find experts who can identify them for us across the country, particularly in Indiana, but elsewhere. We've gone to the Chicago Museum of Natural History, and we've gone to other institutions, Smithsonian, and we just don't have experts who know many of the insects in many of these orders beyond family. They can't get it down to genus or species.
It's really kind of shocking to me that a study like this hasn't been done previously. But
yeah, we're stunned at what we're finding, and then we're realizing that we're on the tip of an iceberg here, and that our state officials are just completely, they're operating in the dark when it comes to forest management in terms of understanding what the impacts of their logging are on Indiana's native biodiversity. In these 4,000 species, a little more than 2,200, 2,300 of them are insects. We've found 150 approximately ichneumonid wasps. These are parasitic wasps. Each one of these wasps species, these ichneumonid wasps or parasitic wasps, has a single host or a group of hosts that it parasitizes. It lays its eggs in these other animals. That's different from the next ichneumonid wasp species. We've got at least 150 of them. Now, many of these, however, we can't identify down to the species level. We can't even identify them to the genus level. We do have them down to the family level, and we know that the largest family, Ichneumonidae, the family that has the majority of these wasps, they don't have any keys below a certain tribe and subfamily, so that if the wasp you find is in another tribe or subfamily, it hasn't yet been, we can't find an expert that has a key for identifying that species yet. Now, they may be there, but we can't find them just yet. So we're having to list these species as what they call morpho by the species at the family level, and just say this: we know is a distinct species. We can tell from looking at it, entomologists that we've consulted, but they don't know what it is. So they're listing it with the words morpho beside it, and so that just tells you how much there is we don't know when you have a parasitic wasp that is stinging other insects out in the forest, or other invertebrates usually, and laying its eggs in them. And there's 150 different kinds of these wasps we've found, and most of them we can't get it down to the genus of what they are. We just have them down to the family. You begin to realize that there's a whole bunch of parasite-host relationships out there in the taxonomic group that is the foundation of the forest ecosystem, the largest group of living creatures above the microbes out there, the most diverse group, but we don't have any idea what those parasite host relationships are or what impacts they have on the plants, the non-vascular plants, the vascular plants, the trees. We don't know. And so that's what I'm saying, that the state is operating in the dark. They really are. They're clueless about what many of these insect host relationships are, and yet they're proceeding forward with these logging plans to eliminate or liquidate the whole amount of 100-plus-year-old forests we have out there without that knowledge. And we hope that by presenting the breadth of what they don't know to them, that we might get them to take stock of this and slow down a little bit. So I should mention that of the 4,000 species, we've also found 24 rare, threatened, or endangered mammals, birds, reptiles, and amphibians on the site. That's under the state and federal lists for those species. We've found more than 200 different insect species that we don't know what they are down to the genus level. We just know what they are to the family level. We've found 23 spiders that are first-time finds for those species in Indiana. They've been found, if you look far enough in the literature, in other states or in Canada, but never found before in Indiana. We've netted five different bats and have acoustic monitoring of three others. Every seven of these eight bats are either rare, threatened, or endangered in the state or and nationally. We've really found a storehouse of rare, threatened, and endangered biodiversity, and of unknown biodiversity, and of vast biodiversity in the Yellowwood, Morgan Monroe backcountry area.
That was Jeff Stant, Executive Director of the Indiana Forest Alliance, speaking about the five-year Eco Blitz the group is conducting in Indiana's state forests.
You are listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Coming up next, the Bicentennial Journal, looking back at 200 years of history in South Central Indiana.
Monroe County's Bicentennial Committee presents the Bicentennial Journal, stories celebrating the rich history of Monroe County. This is my Monroe County story. I am Glenda Murray, and today I want to share information about Maud Showers, one of the strong leaders in Monroe County. Maud was the daughter of a prominent local farmer and landowner. She married Hull Showers, the youngest Showers brother, at age 16 in 1879. Together, they had three children and built a fine home at the corner of 6th and Lincoln, where the city parking lot is now, between the History Center and the library. December of 1886, Hull became ill and died, leaving Maud a widow at age 23. But before he died, Hull made a will that gave Maud one-third interest in the Showers Company, which at that point was a growing business in town making furniture. Maud probably did not have much formal education, but she was a smart, organized woman, and she grew into one of the leaders of her day. She was active in the local Christian church, in its missionary work, in the temperance campaign against alcohol, and in the Bloomington Equal Suffrage Club. Maud married again in 1890 and moved to Indianapolis, but by 1894, she had lost both of her parents, lost a baby, divorced her husband, moved back to Bloomington, and took back the name Maud Showers. Once she returned, she threw herself back into the community. Her brother-in-law, James Showers, retired from Showers Brothers in 1903, leaving William Showers as president of the company and Maud as the vice president. Between them, they owned the controlling interest in the company. Her daughter and son both became stockholders in later years. Maud was the president of the Local Council of Women from 1903 to 1906. The local council was the umbrella organization for many local women's groups, including the Women's Christian Temperance Union, the YWCA, the Cemetery Association, which led to the fixing up and naming the old graveyard as Rose Hill Cemetery, and many other organizations. The local council supported improvements in sanitation and hygiene, tree and flower planting, education, and charity for those in need. The local council also saw the need for a public hospital and library. By 1905, the need for a hospital was foremost on the local council's mind, and the local council purchased the Hopewell Farm at what is now 2nd and Rogers, converting the two-story red brick house into a hospital for 10 patients. Maud was president of the local council, as I mentioned, and she was also president of the new hospital board. She was also intimately involved in the development of the Carnegie Library to replace what she called, quote, the small library a few women have been conducting in a room in the courthouse, using such books as have been given by various people, largely for children, end quote. Maud married again in 1912. She continued to be active in the community,
especially in the hospital and library boards, until her health began to decline in the 1930s. She died in 1936. Her obituary listed the many organizations she had participated in, but instead of listing those for you, I want to close with comments from Carol Krauss, who wrote a wonderful book that was published in 2012 about the Showers brothers and what that company and its founding family meant to Bloomington. Carol said, quote, "Maud was an intelligent woman, a very good public speaker, a savvy political lobbyist, and an indefatigable campaigner for her host of good causes." Carol continued, "The farmer's daughter, who had married at 16, had made it her goal to utilize opportunities to help others who were less fortunate. Maud did more than anyone else in Bloomington, except for the two Showers brothers themselves, to make the city into a much better place than it originally was." End quote. That's quite a legacy, and I thank Carol for writing the book, and I honor Maud Showers for her work over the years.
Join us next week for another edition of the Monroe County Bicentennial Journal.
Support for the Bicentennial Journal and WFHB comes from Monroe County and Visit Bloomington. More information about Monroe County's Bicentennial is available at monroecounty200.us.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Andrew McKieran, Graham Capito, and Wes Martin, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Wes Martin.
The Bicentennial Journal is produced by Kate Welch with help from Joyce Poling. Our engineer is executive producer Wes Martin with help from Kevin Oliver. Our theme music is provided by Ben Lumsdaine, Scott Schmedke, and Danny Graff. For WFHB, I'm Todd Wicks.
And I'm Don Guerra. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast as well as all other WFHB news programming online at wfhb.org.
And you, too, can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, please email news@wfhb.org.
Stay tuned for Counterspin, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting's weekly radio show, providing a critical examination of national headlines. That's coming up next on WFHB.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB Bloomington Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news@wfhb.org. You can become a Daily Local News volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. You can find an archive of past shows and individual news reports online at wfhb.org and catch live broadcasts of the Daily Local News Monday through Thursday at 5 p.m. We are local, longer.